The eighth chapter of Daniel tonight. From the eighth chapter on is a different language for a different purpose. Now written in the book of, written in the language of the Hebrew language, is what I'm trying to say. We're reading in the third year of the reign of Belshazzar, a vision appeared unto me, even unto me, Daniel, after that which appeared unto me at the first. So we stayed here in the third year. In chapter 7, verse 1, we have in the first year, he saw the first vision. And we talked about that, that being showing forth political side of our arch enemy in the last days, political side. While the chapter tonight shows forth a religious side. Chapter 7 showed forth as the Gentiles would look at it. Chapter 8 shows as the Jews would look at it. The thought here of the third year doesn't necessarily mean a definite time. Actually, we don't know how much time it spanned. It could have been as much as 3 years, or it could have been as much as 1 year. He had the first vision at the beginning of Belshazzar's first year. And the second vision at the end of his third year, then we would have about 3 years difference between them. But if we would have had his first vision at the end of his first year, third, and the second vision at the beginning of his third year, we'd have just a little over a year difference. So it doesn't necessarily set a time in there, as a lot of commentaries definitely put in there. I feel that chapter 8 is toward the end, possibly just a little while before he met with Belshazzar with the handwriting on the wall. There's no way of proving any of those things, though. We don't know. We do read in there that Daniel wasn't surprised at the handwriting on the wall. I feel like he understood and knew even before he went to the palace to see it. He knew what was going on, because God had revealed all of these things unto him. So Daniel had plenty of time, is another thought, to meditate between his first vision and his second vision, even if it was just 1 year. He still had plenty of time to think about it, pray about it, and try to get the mind of the Lord on what it is. Another thing I want us to note is the first person pronoun. Before this, everything was written in the second person, as though maybe somebody else would have written it. But this was done for a purpose. We believe that Daniel wrote the whole thing. But the reason that it's written in the second person up till now is because we was looking at it through the eyes of a Gentile, and Daniel was not a Gentile. But now things are different. There's a change here. And notice even in verse 1, in the third year of the reign of Belshazzar, the vision appeared unto me, even unto me, as though he is stressing this point, even unto me, Daniel, after that which appeared unto me at the end. And then notice the eyes in verse 2 and 3, all the way through here, the first person singular. This is telling us that we're looking through different eyes here in chapter 8 than we were previous to this. The fact that Daniel put his name on this as a kind of a signature. And Daniel is seen here as a Jew prophet. So this gives us the time. Verse 2. And I saw in the vision, and it came to pass, when I saw, that I was at Shushan the palace, which is in the province of Elam, and I saw a vision, and I was by the river Euphrates. Daniel, like John, and also like Ezekiel, saw their spirit was taken out of their body and transported to another time. Daniel's body was in Babylon, and his spirit was taken out to Shushan. John was on the Isle of Patmos, and his spirit was taken out of his body, Revelation 1:10, to the day of the Lord, or to the Lord's day. So also in Ezekiel 8, I'm not going to turn to all that, but You can read that for yourself. At the time that Daniel saw this, Shushan wasn't a large city. Now, at the time that his spirit went there, it was a large city. So he was taken in time also, as well as in body. Talk about time travel, you see. It didn't become a large city until the Persian Empire became strong. And then the palace, you see, was made there in Shushan. We read in Nehemiah 1:1 that the palace was there. And then in Esther 1, chapter 1, I don't remember the verses, but we read that the palace was in Shushan during Ahasuerus' reign. But you see, we're talking about it was still in the third year of Belshazzar. And this kingdom was just getting to a good start. They had already conquered Nineveh, and now they had come down to Babylon. So we read here in verse 2 that I saw in the vision. Remember, this is a vision. And it came to pass when I saw that I was at Shushan in the palace in the province of Elam. I saw in the vision. And so we repeat this fact now for a reason for us to get in our mind that this is a vision and nothing else. The reason now that he was taken to Shushan was because this insignificant little town in Persia was to become the capital of a vast empire. He said, when I perceived that I was not at Babylon, see, when I perceived that I was in Persia instead. And the question might come up, well, if he had never been there, then how did he know that he was in Persia? It hints that he wasn't there, because we read that he kept the gate. He sat at the gate of Babylon. Yeah, 249. It says that Daniel requests that the king set Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the affairs of the providence of Babylon, but Daniel sat in the gate of the king. We don't read of any other changes along this line. So I feel like he'd never been there. So if he hadn't, then how would he know where he was? Well, I believe just like John, the Spirit told him where he was. Part of his vision, and it was revealed to him by God. You see, Elam was not a part at that time of the Babylonish empire. So when he realized where he was, there were three places mentioned in this verse: Shushan, Elam, and the river Ulab. The providence, the city, and the river. The word Shushan comes from a Hebrew word that means a lily, and it derived this word from another root word that means brightness or shining, something that would attract attention. I think one place is translated a bugle, I believe, but it has to do with the beauty and everything. Or I think one place is translated cheerful. This is what it was before it expanded, before it became something else. I think it was changed to Shua, Shua, I believe, at a later time. The word Elam means a hidden heap, and the Elamites were Shemites. They were from the same family as the Jewish people were. The Jews were Shemites as well. They should have been friends, shouldn't they? But that put Daniel in the right prospect, looking at the same thing, even at a different angle. I like to call this a viewpoint of Daniel. He just is simply seeing things differently, in a different way. All right, verse 3. Then I lifted up mine eyes and saw, and behold, there stood before the river a ram, which had two horns, and the two horns were high, but one was higher than the other, and the higher came up last. The first vision, part of the vision, is a ram. In verse 20, there is no question of who this ram is, because God tells us. In verse 20, we read that the ram which thou sawest, having two horns, are the kings, plural, of Media and Persia. Now, the fact that horns always speak of power prophetically in the scriptures, the fact that one horn was high and the other one was still growing. Notice the language there, that two horns were high, but one was higher than the other, and the higher came up last. Now, we also know by history that to begin with, the Medes were quite conquerors, but the Persians became stronger as time went on. Darius finally gave up the kingdom to Cyrus, and it was Cyrus's name, you see, that is written in the scripture, and not Darius. We read last week in Isaiah 44 and 45. In 44, Cyrus is called my shepherd. In chapter 45, Cyrus is called God's anointed. And we read all this last week. I'm not going to turn it again. But it was Cyrus who became the great one because he was God's choice, not Darius. The ram, now Daniel no doubt understood the ram in a measure because he had had the bear before, and the bear raised one side higher than the other. And he understood, even from Daniel 2, he understood that the breast and the arms of silver was of another kingdom other than Babylon. So he understood it even way back there during Nebuchadnezzar's time that someday there's going to be another kingdom rise up. Chapter 7 shows this other kingdom as a bear, but chapter 8 shows the same kingdom as a ram. Now here's the difference. Through the eyes of the Gentiles, this kingdom was a ferocious animal that would kill and eat and stamp the residue with its feet. But now we see through Jewish eyes and through the eyes of God that this is a domestic. Wasn't near as ferocious as we've seen before. But we read in verse 4 that the ram pushed. I saw the ram pushing westward and northward and southward so that no beast might stand before him. Neither was there any that could deliver out of his hand. But he had according to his will and became great. Now there's so much wonderful thoughts in this verse, but this ram pushed in three different directions. The westward would be the same as Lydia and also into Rome eventually, Lydia. And then the southward would be Egypt and the westward would be Babylon. Remember that, you know, northward. Yeah, these are the same as the three ribs that we had in chapter 7, the same one. We have Babylon, Egypt, and Lydia. And there was other places in between, too, like Palestine and some others that felt the effect of him. But no beast. Now notice other nations are called beasts, even though they may not have been involved in this exactly. They're still beastly. Anybody that is not born again is a beast in the sight of God. So no beast, no Gentile force could hinder him or stand before him, and none could deliver out of his hand. But he did according to his will and became great. And how God blessed Cyrus, even as we read a while ago, he was God's man, because God was blessing him. This was the reason that he became great. He was doing the will of God. God wanted him to make a proclamation to send the children of Israel back to their homeland, which he did, as we read in Nehemiah. And also later on in Zerubbabel and Ezra and Nehemiah, and God used a lot of people during that time to bring his will. And as long as even ungodly people are doing the will of God, God will bless them. And so he became great. Daniel didn't fully understand even yet what was going on, and he kept watching. And as I was considering, he kept watching. This Media-Persia empire lasted about 219 years, from 549 BC to 330 BC. It probably seemed like it never ended. Daniel physically saw part of this empire, but he never saw any more than this. He never saw any of the he-goat that we're going to read in verse 5. This is the next world empire that was to come on the scene. So he said, while I was considering, behold, a he-goat came from the west upon the face of the whole earth and touched not the ground. And the goat had a notable horn between his eyes. Again, in verse 21, leaves us without doubt who this he-goat is. We read, and the rough goat, notice he talked about a rough goat in verse 21, is the king of Grecia. Great horn between his eyes is the first king. And we've talked about this king before, and the first king was Alexander the Great that was to come. But here we read that the interpretation of this from Gabriel's own lips called him, the he-goat, a rough goat rather than the he-goat. The word rough comes from a Hebrew word that means a shaggy goat. It's the same word that's used for Esau when he's called a hairy man. When Esau was born, he was called a hairy man. It also speaks of the old creation that God uses. The goat was used for a sin offering. And all of these things we collect in our mind, you know, of how God uses it. And it speaks of the natural man and how God can use a natural man to bring his things to pass. He didn't prophesy concerning Alexander the Great, but we always know, I mean, as a person, but we all know that he knew what was coming on. Think about that. 200 years down the line, God knew. Isn't it good that God knows the future of all things? Then why do we try to figure out life? Let's just leave it to him. He's the one that knows all about life. You know, you never can figure out life. Things just happen like that and life changed. Everything has changed. But here we have one that knows 200 years down the line and thousands of years down the line and all about eternity. And I personally think it's wonderful that God knows all of these things. Well, this one comes from the west, and then we read that it's Greece. So Greece is on the west side. And we read that on the face of the whole earth, from the west, on the face of the whole earth. This is the known world at that time. The Grecian Empire become a vast empire. It went all the way from Greece through Mesopotamia. The east border went all the way to the river Indus, I-N-D-U-S, which is in what we know today as Pakistan. When I was in India during World War II, Afghanistan and Pakistan was all part of India. Now it's been separated. But this seemed to be a dividing line even back in the Grecian time when they ruled. And this was a vast empire. Went all the way from Egypt up north, even past the Caspian Sea. And God gave it to him. I think it's marvelous. God looks down the ages and has people picked out for a certain thing. This Alexander the Great. And he was truly a great man. And we read that this goat touched not the ground. That speaks of two things. One is the speed in which it can move. In chapter 7, we saw it as the leopard. I think it's verse 6. The same kingdom as a leopard. I think the thought here, and not only the speed, but the ability to move an army and pounce on the enemy without them knowing they're there. The quietness of it. Also, nothing to hinder. You see, it's a thought I believe that we have. He touched not the ground. How fast and unhindered he could be. And he had a notable horn between his eyes. And we read what this horn was. It was the first king, or Alexander the Great. But the thought between his eyes is interesting. Or we might say within his forehead. This has a lot of things, thoughts in it that run through my mind this morning as I was reading this. Right here is where our memory and thinking part is. Right here in the front. So the power. See, horns speak of power. One horn, one ruler, one power, and one mind, pushing, pushing, pushing. And what great warrior this man was. But he came to the ram, verse 6, and had two horns, that had two horns, which I had seen stand before the river. And I ran unto him in the fury of his power. Now, notice how often the river is used here. River has a twofold thought. One, when it's just a river, it has a thought of soothing, refreshing condition. But when it overflows its banks, then it's a dangerous condition, isn't it? But we don't see it doing that. And so he's just standing there. Notice earlier here we read that a ram stood, that's in verse 3, before the river. He wasn't moving. He was just standing there. So the aggressor was not the Persian, but the Grecian was the aggressor. And we see that in history, that this is a fact. And the anger that he had. Then in verse 7, well, when it's talked about an overflowing or combing over its banks, it has a different thought. Yes, I don't know. So I can answer any question you have. The Grecians were aggressors. Well, they had already done their aggressing, and they were just standing at this time, you see. They weren't doing anything. And they weren't the aggressive either, ever. When they took Babylon, they didn't have to use force to take Babylon. The Babylonian people were willing to have a change. They opened the floodgates for them to come in and welcomed them into the city. They didn't have to be that aggressive. I think we can see all of this in these verses that Daniel was seeing. You know, when you see something, you don't always write down everything. I think he did, but the thoughts are in there. In verse 7, and I saw him come close to the ram. He was moved with terrible anger, colier, against him, and smote the ram, break his two horns, colon. So all the power of Persia was broken off at that point. Now, I think it's good if you have time to find an encyclopedia or a history book and read into all of that. I don't have time to do that in time we have here. And there was no power in the ram to stand before him. And he cast him down to the ground and stamped upon him. And there was none that could deliver the ram out of his hand. Reason? It was God's time to make a change. There is no deliverance when God wants to do something. So verse 8, therefore the he-goat waxed very great. And how great he became. The word notable on this horn comes from a Hebrew word that means something to attract attention. And how great this was. Surely Alexander the Great attracted attention. The conquering was about 330 B.C. that this took place. Verse 8, therefore the he-goat waxed very great, and when he was strong, the great horn was broken, and before it came up four notable ones toward the four winds of heaven. The great horn then was broken off. Alexander the Great died at 33 years of age. There are different accounts of his death, and I don't really know who's right. One history book said he died of a broken heart because there was no more worlds to conquer. Another thought is he died an alcoholic and in a drunken stupor. Another one seemed to think that he may have had a deep depression, but whatever he died a young man. It was God's time for him to die. Because we read it prophesied here that this great horn was broken when he was strong. Not after he got to be an old man, but when he was strong, when he was still in his youth. The horn was broken. And for it came up, or in the place of it came up, four notable horns. Each one of these horns were great and attracted attention. That's why they too were called notable horns. And these four horns now are the same as the four heads upon the leopard. Remember in chapter 7, the leopard had four heads. We have the same thought here in this. Verse 22, we read the answer to that. Now that being broken, whereas four stood for it, four kingdoms shall stand up out of the nation, but not in his power. So we have four kingdoms coming up out of this one power, one nation. Four heads, seven, six, and we've already had that. There was Egypt, Macedonia, Rome, and Syria. These were broken into Macedonia with Syria and Macedonia and Babylon. But these are the same as these four heads. And notice they're called four winds, one toward the four winds of heaven. And we talked about these winds before. Winds always speak of spirits. And so it's how the spirit was working at that time upon the known world. Both, and what seems to be evil is also in the will of God. So God's spirit was working and the evil spirits are working. But God always has his way. The evil spirits never have their way. He uses them for his own benefit. So verse 9 then, we have a change. And I want us to notice how things are altogether different at the beginning of verse 9. And out of one of them came forth a little horn, which waxed exceedingly great, and pushed south and toward the east and toward the pleasant land. Waxed great even unto the host of heaven, and it cast down some of the host of the stars to the ground, and stamped upon them. And yea, he magnified himself even to the prince of the host, and by him the daily sacrifice was taken away, and the place of the sanctuary was cast down. And a host was given him against the daily sacrifice by reason of transgression, and it cast down the truth to the ground and practiced and prospered. Now this carried on after, let's put it this way, after Alexander the Great died, the Syrian Macedonian group began to be strong. A man by the name of Seleucus began to reign. He reigned from 358 to 280 B.C. Seleucus, S-E-L-E-U-C-U-S. He became king over Syria and Babylon, this area through there, in 242. And I just copied this out of the history book. So in 242 B.C., Antiochus III became king. He was called Antiochus the Great. Can we spell his name too? It's A-N-T-I-O-C-H-U-S. And he became a great king. When he died, his son became king in 175 B.C., and his name was Antiochus Epiphany the Third. And I'll spell Epiphany for you too, if you want me to. E-P-I-P-H-A-N-E-S. And E-S sounds like a Z. Epiphanies. And this man was known as the most vicious man that ever ruled during that time. He was out to annihilate the Jewish people. He had a terrible hatred toward the Jewish people. And I brought with me tonight a book of the Apocryphas, and I want to read a little bit out of there concerning this era that we're talking about, and you could understand this man a little better, I believe. Now, I might explain this, that the Apocryphas are a book, well, in the Douay version, they're between Malachi and Matthew, but they're the only ones that accept this as being legitimate, actually. All the books in the Apocryphas, except the books of the Maccabees, are fictional. They were written for the purpose of, during this man's reign, to encourage the Jews and get them to fight against, to take a stand against this man's terrible, terrible desires. And another thing I want to say about Antiochus, his onslaughter against the Jewish people was entirely religious. It had nothing to do with politics. They were already under his rule politically. It had nothing to do with politics. And we need to note this fact, because we're going to come back to the thought later on. But things were terrible. I'm going to read just a little bit through here. In chapter 4, verse 7, it says, "But after the death of Seleucus, when Antiochus, called Epiphanes, took the kingdom, Jason, the brother of Onesus, labored underhand to be the priest, and promised unto the king by intercession 360 talents of silver, and of other revenue 80 talents. Besides this, he promised to assign 150 more, if he might have license to set him up in a place for exercise, and for the training up of the youth in the fashion of the heathen, and to write them of Jerusalem by the name of Antiochus." This man wanted to be the priest. He wanted to control the youth. He wanted to bring in heathen doctrine. Now, I'm reading this so we realize that all of this is religious. There's nothing political here. It's all religious. On down further in verse 13, "Now such was the height of Greek fashion, and increased of heathenism manner through the exceeding profaneness of Jason, that ungodly wench, and no high priest, that the priest had no courage to serve any more at the altar." And so they were all taken away from this religious service, and it was all changed to heathen religion. This isn't an odd thing, because Constantine, when he became emperor of Rome, he tried to do the same thing. He brought in heathen teachings into Christianity. The only difference is Constantine was more cunning and crafty about it than we read here. On down further in verse 23, I want to read, "3 years afterward, Jason sent Menelaus, the aforesaid Simon's brother, to bear the money unto the king, and to put him in mind of certain necessary matters. But he being brought to the presence of the king, when he had magnified him for the glorious appearance of his power, got the priesthood for himself." everybody was after this rulership, religious rulership, by 300 talents of silver. So he came with the king's mandate, bringing these things, became as time went on. I just wanted us to see how terrible this man was. Anyone who refused to worship in a pagan way was simply put to death. There was nothing else. I'm going to read from verse 6 a little bit, chapter 6 rather. "Not long after this, the king sent an old man of Athens to compel the Jews to depart from the law of their fathers, and not to live after the laws of God, to pollute also the temple of Jerusalem, and to call it the temple of Jupiter Olympicus, and that in Gerizim of Jupiter, the defender of the stranger, as they did desire that dwell in the place. And the coming in of this mischief was sore and grievous to the people, for the temple was filled with riot and reviling by the Gentiles, who dallied with harlots." Now this was another custom of heathen worship, was temple prostitutes, in order to raise money to finance the temple. We see a lot of money raising today. But anyway, they dallied with harlots, and had to do with women within the circuit of the holy place, and besides that, brought in things that were not lawful. The altar also was filled with profane things which the law forbid. Neither was it lawful for a man to keep the Sabbath, or ancient feasts, or to profess him to be at all to be a Jew. And in the day of the king's birth, every month, they were brought by bitter constraint to eat of the sacrifice." This was to honor the king's birthday. And by the way, I'll throw this in. Other than this, in the Bible, there's only two people that had a birthday in all the Bible. The first one was Pharaoh, and the baker lost his head at Pharaoh's birthday party. The other one was Herod, and John the Baptist lost his head at that birthday party. And here's another king that had a birthday and forced them to eat sacrifices. When his feast was kept, the Jews were compelled to go in possession, procession, I can't even say it, procession to Bacchus carrying ivy. Moreover, there were, I'm just reading this to show that all of this is religious. Now, if they didn't do it, here is what happened to them. I'm going to read from verse 10 of chapter 6. For there were two women brought who had circumcised their children, who when they had openly led around about the city, the babies hanging at their breasts, they cast them down headlong from the wall. And others that had run together into caves nearby to keep the Sabbath day secretly, being discovered to Philip, was burned together and because they made a conscience to help themselves for the honor of the most sacred day. There wasn't any escaping of this. The man by the name of Eleazar, one of the principal scribes, an aged man, and of a well-favored countenance, was constrained to open his mouth and to eat swine's flesh, which is forbidden by the law. But he choosing rather to die gloriously than to live strained with such an abomination, spit it forth, and came to his own accord to the torment. He deliberately offered himself to be tormented rather than eat swine's flesh. In chapter 7, it came to pass also that seven brethren with their mother was taken and compelled by the king against the law to taste swine's flesh and were tormented with scourges and whips. But one of them that spake first said thus, "What wouldest thou ask and learn of us? We are ready to die rather than to transgress the law of our fathers." Then the king, being enraged, commanded pans and cauldrons to be made hot, which forthwith being heated, he commanded to cut out the tongue of him that spake first, and to cut the uttermost parts of his body, the rest of the brethren and his mother looking on. Now when he was thus maimed in all of his members, he was commanded to put him yet alive to be brought to the fire and to be fried in the pan, and the vapors of the pan was for a good space dispersed, and exhorted one another with the mother to die manfully, thus saying thus. And so I'm not going to read all that, but each one of them was killed separately, and with a mother looking on, she was given an opportunity, said, "Now you just tell them to eat this pig, he won't die." And she said, "Die like men." She encouraged them to die. And I'm not going to read all of that. But the reason I read this now, I have a motive for it. I want us to see that what we're reading here, what I read in this book, is only a drop in the bucket to what is going to be in the last days. I want us to see that this prophecy is a twofold prophecy. It had a partial fulfillment in Antiochus Epiphany, but it has a yet greater fulfillment even in the last days. Now let's look a little bit ahead of the story and notice in verse 17, the latter part of it, it says, "O son of man, for at the time of the end shall be the vision." Now, notice the singular context here. The whole vision, not just a section of it, but all of the vision is for a time of the end. We're going to go back over this now a little bit and see how the same system, the same attitude will be, again, only even more so. Like I said, what we read of is only a shadow, only a little picture of that which is to come. It's going to be so terrible in the tribulation time that Jesus said, except the day be shortened and be no flesh left on the earth. 24th chapter of Matthew. So let's go back. And out of one of them came forth a little horn. Now this little horn in verse 9 is not the same as the little horn in chapter 7. The one in chapter 7 is entirely political and represents the Antichrist. The one in chapter 8 is entirely religious and represents the false prophet. But they'll both be in harmony, working together and pulling together for the purpose of overthrowing God and his sayings and his people. So we read here that this one little horn became predominant above all the others, which waxed exceedingly great toward the south, or Egypt, and toward the east, or Babylon, and toward the pleasant land, which would be Palestine. That's in God's sight, this is still the pleasant land. And it waxed great even to the host of heaven. Now, what is God's host of heaven on the earth? Is it not his people? But we're not talking about the church here. We're talking about the Jewish people. And this, without doubt, represents the remnant of God's people, God's Jewish people, that will be on the earth at that time. And it cast down some of the host and the stars to the ground and stamped upon them. Now we saw that Antiochus did the same thing. And if it wasn't for God raised up a man by the name of Judas Maccabee and his brothers. And his dad first was raised up to fight against this great army that come down to annihilate them. He defeated them. He fought this battle, and every battle he fought except one or two, he was quite victorious. Well, it cost Antiochus the Epiphany so much money to send his army down there that he decided that he was going to need more money in his treasury. So he divided his army, he took half of them and went to Persia, to where there was some palaces there that he could raise. He took the other half and sent them by a man by the name of Philip down to go ahead and finish the work in Palestine. What? Macedonia, right. Now, history tells us that Antiochus was defeated in the area of Elam that we was talking about here before. He came out, and I can't quote all the history, but he came out and he died in a tent in the desert, and it says that he was so eaten of worms alive that he stunk, and even his best of friends wouldn't even come around him because the odor of his body was so great. Now, again, he's a type not of the Antichrist, as most people tell you, but he's a type of the false prophet because his attitude was religious and not political. And this is the difference between the two. And this is what we're seeing in all of this. Well, Philip was defeated too. And about that time then, Rome began to send their forces because they saw the weakness of Syria. God was bringing all of these things to pass. It's just more, and when I look today and see him shifting nations around and doing what he will with these nations, it just thrills our heart because we know that the end time is closer all the time. All right, let's get back on the subject here. So all the stars of the ground are the luminaries of God's Jewish leaders in the last days. Verse 11, yea, he magnified himself even to the prince of the host, and by him the daily sacrifice was taken away, and the place of the sanctuary was cast down. Now in Daniel 9, verse 27, let's turn over and read there just a minute. And he, now the word he in verse 27 is the Antichrist, but these two will be working in harmony together. and he shall confirm a covenant with many for 1 week. See, this is political now, not religious. But the next statement is religious and not political. In the midst of the week, he shall cause the sacrifice and the oblation to cease. Now, we read that it's this little horn that comes out of the Grecian that is going to do this. The first horn come out of Rome. The second little horn comes out of Greece. Rome isn't even mentioned in chapter 8 at all. So we read that he's going to cause the sacrifice to cease. Now, this is the daily sacrifice, and it will be in the midst of the week. Now, in the beginning of the week, the sacrifice, they'll be allowed to offer their sacrifices. This will be a part of a peace treaty that they'll make, that they'll say peace and safety, as we read in 1 Thessalonians 5. The attitude of verse 11 is the same attitude as the Antichrist would have, as we read in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, that he'll exalt himself. And so we read this same ungodly attitude. It's the same attitude that Lucifer had in the 11th chapter of Isaiah. He wanted to exalt himself above the heavens, above the throne of God. So we have a satanic attitude here. And then he takes it out, you see, on the daily sacrifice and the place of the sanctuary that was cast down or made worthless as far as Jewish sacrifices are concerned, or Jewish worship. Now, you'll do this as Antiochus offered the pig upon the Jewish altar and defiled the altar, so the false prophet will put an image in the temple of God to defile the temple of God again. And we read of this in the last part of the 13th chapter of Revelation. And we've already read all that, I believe, and if you haven't read it, why, turn to it. This is the second beast that will come up out of the earth. He'll cause everybody to worship the first beast, bring fire down of heaven. He'll perform wonders, bring fire down out of heaven. And if anybody doesn't worship, they're going to be killed. And we had the same thing in the Maccabees. You see, these two run parallel. So the sacrifice will be taken away. Now, this will be taken away, as we read, in the middle of the week. And the place of the sanctuary then will be defiled. Now, the defilement of this, well, let's read verse 12 first. And a host was given unto him against the daily sacrifice to by reason of transgression. And it cast down the truth to the ground and practiced and prospered. So the actual battle will be against God. Is against his daily sacrifice, and the reason is by transgression. Now, this word transgression has to do with the image itself. It's called an abomination in Daniel 9:27. Jesus called it abomination of desolation in Matthew 24. It's the sin of this image that will cause the death of people that will not worship the way they're supposed to worship. Notice it says that the truth was cast to the ground. And it, notice the colon there, and it referring to the horn, practiced and prospered. And so they will for a short time, for less than 7 years. Actually, their prospering will take place in 1,260 days or 3.5 years. Their prospering won't be very long. Verse 13 and 14. Then I heard one saint speaking to another and said unto the certain saint which spake, how long shall be the vision concerning the daily sacrifice and the transgression of desolation to give both the sanctuary and the host to be trodden underfoot? And he said unto me, for 2,300 days, then shall the sanctuary be cleansed. Now, we say, who are the saints here? Remember, this is a vision. Daniel is taken to the end time now. And so the saints that we read of are the Jewish remnant, the people of God, that accept Christ. You become a saint when you receive Christ as your Savior, or a holy one. And so here we have the remnant speaking. The question is, how long? How long, O God, holy and true? How long will this be that be given, desolation will be given? Or let's call this transgression of desolation, abomination of desolation, that will be set up in the holy place. How long will it be given to the sanctuary and the host be trodden underfoot? And then we have a definite number here, 2,300 days, then shall the sanctuary be cleansed. So the starting point of our figuring is at the cleansing of the sanctuary. Not at the beginning, but at the cleansing or at the end. When Jesus comes to set up his kingdom, he will cleanse the sanctuary so that the Jewish people can offer sacrifices during the kingdom age. We start here at a definite time when Jesus comes, the last half of Revelation 19, and we date back through the tribulation 1,300 days. Now, we're going to get to some of these figures in chapter 9 a little better and how God dates. But this would add up to 6 years, 4 months, and 20 days that will be given to defile the sanctuary. The defiling of that sanctuary will take place right after they begin to offer sacrifices. And it'll get worse and worse, and 250 days before the middle of the 7 years, then the sacrifice will be taken away completely, and then the abomination of desolation will be set up. So we have a definite time. Now, Daniel didn't understand yet, and I don't blame him. I don't think I would have. The reason we can understand is because a lot of this is history, isn't it? But Daniel didn't understand. So we read in verse 15, it came to pass that when I, Daniel, had seen the vision, I sought for the meaning. Then, behold, there stood behind me as the appearance of a man. And I heard a man's voice say between the banks of Ulai, which called and said, Gabriel, make this man to understand the vision. This man can be none other than the Lord Jesus Christ. He's the only one that has the authority to command Gabriel to do anything. Now, Gabriel is an archangel, and all the time we see him, it's for the purpose of speaking. He was a speaker. When Jesus was born, it was Gabriel that announced it to Mary. And in the book of Jude, we read that Michael, the other archangel, wouldn't speak at all to Satan, to the devil. He wouldn't speak to him. Michael was the warrior of the two, and he see him in battle. But Gabriel, you see him as a speaker. So Gabriel was commanded to let Daniel understand these things. Now, all of this is still in the vision. So he came near where I stood, and when he came, I was afraid and fell upon my face. And he said unto me, understand, O son of man, what the time, for the time of the end shall be the vision. So he was afraid. I feel that this is reverence. This is a godly fear that came upon him. And he humbled himself in this fear. He fell on his face. And while he was still on his face, Gabriel said to him, for this is a time of the end shall be the vision. Now, this end that we're talking about here is the end of Gentile rule. And this will be the beginning of the end. The end of Gentile rule. Now, the Gentiles are given a particular length of time. And when Jesus takes his throne, Gentile times are over. So this, the verse 17 brings us to the time when the King of Kings and Lord of Lords takes his throne in heaven in Revelation 4. So this is the Gentile end of Gentile time. Now, as I was speaking, he was speaking to me, I was in a deep sleep upon my face toward the ground, and he touched me and set me upright and said, behold, I will make thee know what shall be the last days of the indignation? For at the time appointed, the end shall be. Now, the end that we have, the last days of verse 19, is not the same as the end in verse 17. This is the end of the indignation. What do we say the indignation was? See? So this brings us on down to the cleansing, you see. The indignation is the abomination of desolation. And so, you see, this brings us all the way down then to the last end of the indignation. Now, he said, Son of man, for the time of the end shall be the vision. But then he continued to talk to him. He touched him and set him upright. Now, this was for a purpose, because we see, as he represented the remnant of Israel in the last days, then they will be set upright in order to understand a later ending that will come upon them. And so we read, for the time appointed, the end shall be. Now, isn't it good that God has everything appointed? He had a definite date set for Jesus to be born. In the fourth chapter of Galatians, we read that when the fullness of time was come, God sent his own son. God had an appointed time, appointed end, you see, shall be. Then he explains the ram and the rough goat. And this is significant and marvelous for us, because these are treated as one people. Now notice that in there. First he tells about the ram, and the ram is political, is of the Medes and the Persians, and they show forth a political system. While the rough goat is Grecian, and they show forth, you see, the religious end of this. So we have two definite non-violent domestic beasts here seen forth, bringing forth peace and safety to begin with. And by the way, the Antiochus army did that to start with. They went in there and fooled them, you know. They fooled them. And we have this in the fourth chapter of Ephesians. It tells us not to be blown around by every wind of doctrine and crafty ways of the devil. I'm not quoting that. You can look that up. And how cunning and crafty they are. All of these is showing forth. Verse 22, now that being broke, whereas he stood up for it, four kingdoms, or four kings we might say, shall stand up out of the nation, but not for in his power. Then we bring the whole thought down in verse 23 to the latter time. And I think this is necessary, because notice what this latter time is. This is the latter time of their kingdom, when the transgressors are come to the full. There's going to be a time when God has taken all he can take from the Gentile world forces. And just like we read in the 15th chapter of Genesis, when Abram made his sacrifice and his covenant with Jehovah, he told Abraham that his people, the Jewish people, would go to another nation for 400 years. And the reason of that is because the transgression of the Amorites is not yet fulfilled. Now, God is going to wait. People wonder why these things are put off. But God is going to wait until the transgression is full. When is the transgression full? When the abomination of desolation has defiled all of God's doings in the temple. And when this happens, when Israel comes to be defeated, when the armies have surrounded her to the uttermost, and there's no place to turn, then God will come to her effect. I think we read that last week in Zechariah, didn't we? God will come to her. So, in the latter times of their kingdom, when the transgression is come to the full, the king of the fairest countenance and understanding, dark sentence, shall stand up. Now, this is the false prophet, without doubt. And he is going to fool people with his great swelling word and his ability to talk. and people will be fooled, I guess is the way I can put it. The word here for dark sentence, an interesting Hebrew word, it means a puzzle or a trick. And that's how he's going to do it. It'll be counterfeit. It'll be trickery. Think of this one guy, Copperfield. And everything he does is illusion. And I believe, and I'll put it that way, that these dark sentences and these things that will fool people will be simply illusions that he'll do. I don't think he'll make this image to speak. But it'll look like he gave life to it. It'll look like he made it to speak. And it'll fool everybody, and they will believe it actually happened. Then in verse 24, and his power shall be mighty, but not by his own power. Well, whose power is it then? Well, it's Satan's power, isn't it? How far will God let these things go? It's a question, you know. How far are they going to go? Well, until God's timing, and then he's going to stop it. And then we read, and he shall destroy wonderfully, or miraculously, or he shall prosper and practice and shall destroy the mighty and the holy people. And we read in the 12th chapter of Revelation of the woman in the wilderness and how he'll try to destroy them. Some of them are going to die. They'll join the souls under the altar of Revelation 5, is it? Yeah, 5. Many of them will die. And it'll look like he's victorious for a while, won't it? But in God's time, God's going to send his son. God is going to cry out, yet I have set my king upon the holy of Zion. Psalms 2. Why do the heathens rage and the people imagine vain things? See? And when their raging is to its fullness, God's going to set his son on the holy hill of Zion. And he has a purpose, because it's going to take this to make the nation Israel see the nail scars in the hand of their Messiah. It's going to take all that. It's a shame it done. It will. They should have saw it in Acts, but they didn't. Verse 25, and through his policy he shall cause craft to prosper in his hand, or craftiness to prosper. Again, study the 14th chapter of Isaiah and the 4th chapter of Ephesians. Deceit will be his number one tool to use in his hand. And he shall magnify himself in his heart. Now both the false prophet and the Antichrist both will have this satanic attitude. By peace shall destroy many. By peace? Oh yeah. By trickery of peace. Remember Ephesians 5, and when they shall say peace and safety. See, this is a false peace. See, you can't have peace without the Prince of Peace. And so this will all be a counterfeit peace, because then sudden destruction shall come upon them. So he shall stand up against the Prince of Princes. Who's that? Yes, who's the Prince of Princes? All right, so this is the one that he really wants to defeat. And I'm going to make this statement too, that if Satan can annihilate the Jewish people, which Antiochus tried to do, then God couldn't be God anymore. He would be defeating God. And you know why? Because God made a promise to Abram. And if God can't keep his promise to Abram, then he can't keep any promises, can he? And he made a promise to David that his seed would reign forever. So God must keep his promises. And that's the reason why all through the years, Satan has tried to annihilate the Jewish people, but they just seem like they keep growing. All of this, though, is against the Prince of Princes. But he shall be broken without hands. What else do we see cut out without hands breaking up? The stone in Daniel 2, doesn't it? And it crushed the toes of them. He shall be broken. Now, we just had this, and I'm going to go over to it, but in the 19th chapter of Revelation, we just had it Wednesday night, so it ought to be fresh on my mind yet, but I want us to see the breaking of this. Verse 19 and 20, and I saw the beast, that's the Antichrist, and the kings of the earth and their armies gathered together for what purpose? To make war against him that sat on the horse on the white horse, that's the Lord Jesus Christ, and against his army. Then we read the consequences of this. And the beast was taken, and with him the false prophet, together as one was taken, that wrought miracles before him with which he deceived them, and that received the mark of the beast, and them that worshipped his image. These both as one, you see, both were cast alive to the lake burning with fire and brimstone. So this will be the end of the Antichrist and the false prophet. So that's what we're reading in our lesson here. So he'll be broken without hands and end up cast into a lake of fire alive, burning with fire and brimstone. You know, justice must be. God must be just. Even in judgment, God must be judged. That's the reason why he had to pour the ultimate of his wrath upon his son hanging on the cross. Because in order to justify the ungodly, God had to be just. That's Romans 3. He's just here. So the end of these will be cast alive together to a lake of fire. Verse 26, and the vision of the evening and the morning, which was told, is true. Is there any doubt about it? Well, we confirm this fact that it's true. It's going to happen just exactly like God said it. I think this was given especially to Daniel because Daniel didn't understand these things. We understand it because we have other scriptures. Daniel didn't have some of the scriptures like Matthew 24 and Second Thessalonians 2, John's vision, and some of the others that we have today. So he had to take it by faith that these things were going to happen. I don't understand it. There's so many things that I don't understand. But I know they're true because God said so. And we believe it. We take it by faith. All right, so he says, the things that are told is true. Wherefore, or because of this, Daniel, shut thou up the vision. It was a closed vision. And by the way, people didn't even try to understand until about the turn of the century. And then God began to open up and reveal to godly men of conditions of the last days. This has been sealed over these years. And so we read here to shut it up. For it shall be many days. What are the many days? Well, the times of the world, Gentile world powers. I think God put this in there so Daniel would know that it wasn't going to be during his lifetime. That would be at a later time. I think Daniel had no idea that it was going to be 2,600 years. But I was thinking about this early this morning, how fortunate we are to be living in these last days. And we see them coming to pass. Verse 27, and I, Daniel, fainted and was sick many days. And I think if I was in Daniel's shoes, I would have too. I would have fainted. But John saw many things that he didn't understand. He fell before the one that was showing him, and he humbled. It's in Revelation chapter 1, isn't it? Yeah, when I saw him, I fell at his feet as dead. And I think I would have too, if I'd have seen such glorious thing. Fell at his feet as dead, and he laid his right hand upon me, saying unto me, fear not, I am the first and the last. So Daniel and John had similar experiences along this line. Afterward I arose and did the king's business, and I was astonished at the vision. See, sounds like he still didn't understand, but none understood it. But you mean a trumpet will sound and the dead in Christ? It doesn't say that that's Gabriel or Michael. Notice how that's worded, and I'll quote to you from the Greek text. It says, a trumpet will sound. The Lord himself shall descend from heaven with a shout, with the voice of a mighty angel. That word ark comes from a Greek word that means first place angel. That there's no angel higher than him. and it doesn't really have an reference to a title, but a position, you know, rather than a title. Jesus is the mighty angel.